So good morning again, everybody. This morning, I have the privilege of introducing a freshman U.S. Senator who has excited millions of Americans with his strongly stated commitment to American exceptionalism and a constitution of small government. Marco Rubio was elected to the U.S. Senate in November 2010 to represent the state of Florida. In a short time, he has distinguished himself as a legislator whose approach to business is grounded in first principles. This commitment was evidenced early on with his very first speech on the floor of the U.S. Senate. He said then, and I quote, "The 20th century was the American century, a century where America's political, economic, and cultural exceptionalism made the world a more prosperous and peaceful place. But now we find ourselves in a new century. And there is this growing sense that for America, things will never be the same, that maybe this century will belong to somebody else." Senator Rubio continued, "Indeed, we do now stand at a turning point in our history, one where there are only two ways forward for us. We will either bring on another American century, or we are doomed to witness America's decline. Another American century is fully within our reach because there is nothing wrong with our people. The American people haven't run out of good ideas, but our government is broken, and it is keeping us from doing what we have done better than any people in the history of the world. This understanding of our heritage, this concern that American governance now has serious structural flaws, and this optimism in the capacity of a free people to do more good than Leviathan, these are the cornerstones of a serious brand of national leadership. Please join me in welcoming U.S. Senator Marco Rubio."
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. The important thing is that you clap after I'm done speaking. That's the. So listen, thank you very much for inviting me and for this opportunity to do this. You've come in from all over the country to Washington at really a critical time in our debate in our country and really touched upon a very important thing. So I'm honored to be a part of it, see a lot of familiar faces, a lot of people that were helpful to us in the past and who helped us get to this place. So. Thank you for the faith a lot of you showed in us and in me during our campaign early on when, quite frankly, I was not the likeliest choice, when I was polling below the margin of error, when, I'd wake up in the morning and wonder what I was doing. But we're glad we did it because we're here at an important point in our history. So your topic, really, I think your organizing principle for the organization, but really for this conference, is really timely. And I want to get it right. It's the Constitution of Small Government? ? It's important that you talk about that because we are having a debate. You know, there's all this noise in Washington about fighting and bickering and bipartisanship and why can't we get along and why can't Republican and Democrats get along and why can't things get done? And part of it is really personality driven. It's just kind of the way things have evolved in the modern day political culture of cable television, the constant need to say something more outrageous than you said yesterday in order to get attention and be noticed, the constant need to feed constituencies that demand, content largely in the media. And so that's all part of it, and I think some of that has infiltrated itself into the political character of our country. I mean, I get to see politicians when the lights are not on, and they don't always act that way. It almost seems like the World Wrestling Federation. I was not a big fan of professional wrestling because I always knew it was fake. Don't say it to a wrestler. Say, it's real. We really, But the point is that one of the most crushing experiences of any young fan of the World Wrestling Federation is if you travel to one of these events and you happen to go to the hotel, and it happened to be the hotel where the wrestlers were staying at, the villain and the hero were like having drinks together after the wrestling thing at the bar, and it just crushed you. It's like, why is Andre the Giant sitting with Ivan the Terrible, whatever, remember the Roddy Piper, whatever. The point is that it just broke people's heart. And so I see politicians when the lights are not on. I see them when they're not on the floor debating these issues, and they don't act that way in real life. People get along, they talk, they have families, they have children, they talk about, they have common things that they speak about. So, but a lot of it is driven by that, and that's part of it. And so the point is there are things, believe it or not, there are things that enjoy widespread support in our country that aren't happening. They're either being held hostage to be part of these bigger things that they disagree on, or quite frankly, it doesn't fit someone's political matrix. In essence, this year's issue of the day is going to be the president's going to go around saying, this Congress refuses to act. Congress is do nothing Congress. They won't do anything. We can't wait. whatever. So he, in essence, that's their strategy. The strategy is we want to be able to campaign against Congress. We want to be able to campaign against Republicans in Congress. We want to be able to say that they refuse to do anything. All they do is block things. And so if that's going to be your campaign theme, then you're not going to be very cooperative in terms of making things happen because it doesn't go with your campaign theme. So that's clearly a factor. We have to break through that. It's unexcusable. There should be no reason why Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, and liberals should be fighting about the things we agree on. On the other hand, there are some significant issues, the big issues that face our country. There's a simple reason why there's not a consensus on those issues. And that is because they are formed as a result of two very different views of the role of government in America and sometimes the role of America in the world. Two very different views. And so when people look at Congress and say it's divided and on major issues they can't agree on things, the reason for that is because in this republic, more often than not, the people who are doing the fighting are basically just expressing what got them elected. They're basically just coming to Washington, D.C. and bringing with them the thoughts and the beliefs of the people who sent them here. And so it's the reason why Jeff Sessions was here earlier today. His constituency, and for the most part, the majority of people in his constituency, their view of the role of government in America is dramatically different from the role that Nancy Pelosi's constituents have in the role of government. And that's why we have elections. This is the central issue at the end of the day, beyond all the noise about the specific public policy. The central issue behind all of these issues is what should our government be doing and what should our government not be doing. And so what you're organized around here today is basically about that central issue. What is the proper role of government in the United States? Proper role of government in the sense of what is the best role of government in terms of the kind of nation we all want. Now, I have said that Americans and others have written about this. Yuval Levin's written about this, and I've taken a lot of it from it, and I really believe that it's true. The American people have always had dual goals. On the one hand, the goal has been to have a nation of real prosperity, the opportunity to accomplish your hopes and dreams, not necessarily financially. Maybe you don't want to make a lot of money, just enough to be able to feed your family, but there's something you love to do, and you'd like to get paid to do it. And that's a particularly American sentiment, although I believe it's universal. That is balanced by a desire for compassion. Americans are not willing to leave people behind. In essence, we're too prosperous of people and too compassionate of people to walk around and see people who are suffering and say, well, let them fend for themselves. You know, let the disabled have to take care of themselves. Let the elderly at 85 years old go out and get another job. People don't believe that. Americans would never accept that. And so for much of the last 100 years, the real debate in America has been how to balance these two competing desires, to have a nation of both prosperity and of compassion. How do we accomplish both of those things? And the answer to that question is what leads us to this point. And it's been the pull and pull, the push and pull, the tug at the heart of America's debate about the proper role of government, and remains so to this day. Now, our founding was based on some pretty profound principles, which I think still define us as a people and, in fact, separate us from the world. And the definitional principles of our founding were that every human being's rights, the source of those rights, are their creator. It's not their government, it's not their king, our self-worth. Your rights as a person, my rights as a person, and by the way, we need to remind ourselves of this, the rights of all people. This is not just exclusive to the people in North America or the people in the United States or the people in the colonies. What they were basically saying is that every single human being, the rights and what defines their worth and their value comes not from government, it comes from their creator. Principle number one. Principle number two was the job of government is not to give you your rights. The job of government is to protect those rights. They went on to say that any government that violates those rights is an illegitimate government. They went on to say in order to protect ourselves from this government, the only power government has is the power we allow you to have. In essence, we'll allow you to have certain rights, certain powers, in order to protect our rights. And if it's not explicitly stated, you cannot have them. And this was a lot of different reasons behind it. Partially, it was the experience folks had had with government up to that point had been very, very negative. But part of it was the natural outflow of this natural rights view of the world. Now, why is that important? A lot of reasons why that's important. But one is because it really distinguishes America from the rest of the world. Without that principle, I think others have argued this, without that notion, without that being the founding kind of core principle of how we were founded as a nation, the American Revolution was just another colonial rebellion. It was just people that wanted another government and other leaders. That's what it was. But that principle is different. It was about more than just having new leaders or a different type of government. It was about creating here a space and a place where those fundamental desires weren't just stated on a piece of paper, but in fact a system of government that protected that. And of course, the natural result of that was a free enterprise system. Again, a free enterprise system based on the notion of economic equality that ultimately led us to this point where most Americans, I think, believe that it shouldn't matter where you're born in life. If you're talented and you're willing to work hard, you should be able to go as far as your hard work and talent will take you, irrespective of what station in life you may be born into. Again, we take that for granted, but that's pretty unique in world history for the most part, and certainly even now in much of the world. So now we reach this point as time goes on and America faces problems. The natural inclination of people is, well, let's solve those problems. And that's normal for policymakers, but for all of us. A problem, you turn on the TV this morning and you will hear about a problem in the world. And the natural reaction is, how can we solve it? What can we do about it? And if you're in the political realm, your natural reaction immediately is, what can the government do about it? Now, is it always, are there people that just believe in a different role of government in our society, and therefore they're constantly looking for opportunities to grow the government's role? Yes. There are people that do not agree that government should be limited. There are people that believe it's a naive concept. There are people that believe that at the end of the day, you know, whether they'll ever admit it or not, they're not fully embracing of self-government as you and I would describe it. They actually think that you need to have a government of really smart people that went to the right school who end up basically protecting us from ourselves. There are people that believe that, whether they admit it or not, they believe that, whether they even realize it or not. But more often than not, what I have found is that it's largely people that think that government's got to step in and do something because it's the only institution in society that can organize itself and move quickly enough to address these issues that we face. And the result is that, by and large, that has been what's motivated this constant and steady expansion of government's role in every aspect of our life. Now, does that mean that every expansion of government's role has had 100% negative outcomes? No, it doesn't mean that. And there are certainly programs that government's been involved in creating which serve a valuable and important purpose. For example, those of us who believe in the free enterprise system believe in a safety net, not as a way of life. I certainly do. I don't speak for everybody in this room. Not as a way of life. Certainly don't think the safety net is something you should rely on for sustenance for the rest of your life. But I believe if you want to have a free enterprise system where people actually are willing to take risk and reach for the stars, you better set up a net so that if they fall, they can stand up and get back up and try again. I believe that we are too rich, too compassionate, and too prosperous of people to say to the infirm, to say to the disabled, to say to the elderly, go out and fend for yourself in the marketplace. Now, what's happened, of course, is that these programs have been designed in a way that they've grown faster than the ability of our economy to sustain it, which is a startling realization when you conclude, when you realize. It's a startling thing to see when you realize that what we have here is only the richest, most prosperous economy in human history. At almost $15 trillion, there is no comparison to the modern American economy at any time in world history. And so we, the richest, most prosperous economy in the history of the world, are confronted by a government so large and so expensive that not even we, the richest, most prosperous economy in the history of the world, can afford it. So that just tells you a little bit about how quickly it's expanded. And so many of these programs and many of this role of government that's been crafted has not only been done in a way that kind of overlooks the wisdom of limitations on government's powers, but has also overlooked the ability to pay for it, with not any regard for the fact that in order to sustain any level of government, you have to have an economy that pays for it. You have to have an economy that can afford it. Your economy has to be able to generate the revenue necessary to pay for whatever role you think government should be playing in your society, and that has to be balanced. Now, for us today, that's at the core of all the debates that we're having. And it's hard to go to people. One of the hardest arguments to make is to try to, you saw a little bit of it last night in the debates and the glimpses of it that I got, that, you know, it's much harder to go to people and explain to them how the market works than it is to explain to people how a new government program works. It's hard to do that, but we have to, because at stake is not only our very prosperity, but ultimately our economic freedom. And it's important that we do that, especially when we're given false choices. The most prevalent false choice in modern American politics is the following. And here's the false choice we're given. That you have, we can choose, there's only two ways forward. We can either rely on big government, or we can rely on big business. We can either rely on Wall Street, or we can rely on Washington. That is a false choice. That is a false choice that absolutely ignores our legacy as a people, the founding principles of our nation, and our history as a nation of extraordinary prosperity. Yes, there's a role for government. We're not anarchists. Well, we're not anarchists. We're not anarchists. I'm not. There are some out there. There is a proper role for government. If this building catches on fire, I want firefighters to show up and put the fire out. That's the proper role of government. If some country threatens our national security, we're not going to go out and hire a whack and hunt. Now I'll get a nasty letter from the whack and hunt offices. But the point is that we're not going to go out and hire some private army to fight them. That's the proper role of the national government, of the federal government. So there is a proper role for government to play. And we're not anti-big businesses. They've played an important role in our economy. But here's why that's a false choice. Neither Washington nor Wall Street is the source of our greatness. The source of our greatness is something much more common, much more understated, and much more misunderstood. And that is the everyday lives of everyday people, hardworking people that every single day are changing the world one day, one block, one family, one community at a time, and you'll never know about it. You'll never know about it. You'll never know about the fact that this morning they gave their neighbor a ride to the doctor. You won't know, because there's not going to be a newspaper article written about it. You'll never know that this morning they took out their life savings and opened up a small business, and that one day that business will employ 20, 50, 100, 150 people. Because they're not on the covers of they're not going to be on the cover of Forbes magazine. You'll never know about the things they're doing to change the lives and our economy, and that happens every single day. And it happens because A, the promise of prosperity is real, and B, they have the freedom to do it. They have the freedom to do it. The belief of people that maybe work in this very hotel that look at somebody else and say, you know, I can do a better job of this than my boss. And when I can save up enough money, I'm going to go out and compete against him or her. Because I can do it better than they can. And that happens over and over, time and time and time again. That is the source of our greatness. The fact that it's possible to do that. And we take it for granted. But listen, every country in the world has billionaires. Every country in the world has government. What they're lacking, and what makes us different, is that here you can start businesses out of the spare bedroom of your home. That you can go to your garage and say, this little corner of our garage is the headquarters of my new S corporation. And 5, 10 years from now, you employ 20, 25 people. There are people in this room that have done that. There are people, as we speak, that are trying to do that. Now, yes, when you do that, you violate the zoning code. But but you can do it. And so let me be clear, because I see some familiar faces from the press. I do not advocate violating the zoning code. I don't advocate violating the zoning code in your garage or in public parks. Let's just hope our local authorities are as understanding with our entrepreneurs as they are with our fellow Americans who are expressing themselves in the political process. So anyway, just wanted to get that in. That really is the source of our greatness. And the question, if we believe that, and I bet you if you told that to people on both parties, say, I believe that. Yes, that's true. That is the source of our greatness. Then you arrive at then I think the argument becomes, all right, then what kind of government makes it easier for you to do that? What kind of government makes it easier for you to do that? Intrusive government or limited government? And that's where the argument's really about. Now, that's what those who disagree with us don't want the argument to be about, but that is what the argument is about. What form of government makes it easier to open up a business out of the spare bedroom of your home? Is it one with an onerous and complicated tax code? Or is it one that has a simple and flattened tax code, one that's easy to comply with and understand, and more importantly, to predict? Which one makes it easier to open up a business out of your garage? Is it one with multiple regulations at the federal, state, local level? Or is it one where regulations are streamlined? Now, again, I'm not here to beat up on big businesses, but they don't like a complicated tax code, and they certainly don't like complicated regulations, but they can deal with it. They can hire the best lawyers, some in this room, accountants, to navigate all that stuff. And if they really don't like it, they can hire the best lobbyists to try to change it. And if they still don't like it, they can relocate and move somewhere else. And so ultimately, big businesses will figure it out, or they won't be here. Who gets destroyed by a government that's too involved? It's the people that we all believe have made our nation great. the everyday people, the hardworking taxpayer who's trying to make it. The people who have made it, they will deal with it. The people who are trying to make it, which also happens to be the thing that sets us apart from the world, are the ones that will struggle with it. There's probably no better, more contemporary example of it than the healthcare law. Irrespective of the theoretical and ideological objections that we may have to a mandate and to whether government should even be involved in the business of health insurance or whether that's a private thing, and that's a very legitimate issue, and it's being litigated as well, and it's important because I think the conclusion will be the right one, I hope. But think about the impact that it has in the real world. If you are a large mega corporation, can you deal with a new healthcare law with all its rules and hoops and hurdles? You can. You can. You don't want to, but you can. You're even large enough to probably be able to pass it through to your customers and prices and your employees and a compensation. Who can't deal with it? Who looks at that stuff and gets scared? The people who are trying to make it. Who opens up the newspapers every day and hears about one more regulation, one more obstacle to entry and decides, this is not the year to leave my job and start a business. This is not the year to take my life savings out of the bank and go out and create opportunity and prosperity. This is not the year to do that. Who gets scared? The people that we say have made our nation unique and great. And that is the real world impact. Forget about the ideology and the intellectual aspect of it for a second. The real world impact of a government that goes beyond where it should properly be is that it destroys and impedes the essence of what separates us economically and ultimately socially and morally from the rest of the world. And that's at the core of the debate we're having in Washington, D.C. right now. And it's frustrating because I don't think it's ill-intentioned. Ultimately, even those of us on the right, even those of us that believe in limited government, have been guilty of that. Because what's our toolbox? You get elected, and what's your toolbox they hand you as a member of the Senate? Your toolbox is laws you can pass and government programs you can fund. And so you see a problem in the world, and you say, all right, what law can we pass? What program can we create to deal with it? And sometimes that's a legitimate conversation. But sometimes, just as legitimate is to go around looking, just as often as we should be looking at what can government do, we should be looking at what should government not be doing. What should government not be doing? And it's critical we win that debate. It's critical that debate be made clear and that choice be made clear to our people, because this is not just about winning the election. One of the most frustrating things about being here in Washington is that politics is covered as a sport. It's not a sport. It may be to the people who cover it and to the insiders that play it. But unlike college football, unlike college basketball, unlike the NFL, there are real life, real world, dramatic consequences to people all over this country and all over this world to the decisions that are being made. This is not about the Republican team and the Democrat team where you paint your face a funny color and you go to the game, you play for 3 hours, and next year we'll play again. What happens here matters. And oftentimes the popular thing to do is the wrong thing to do. And that's where leadership comes into play. And that's where the difference between public opinion and public judgment is so critical. Public opinion is what people think the first time you tell them something. Public judgment is what people come to believe when responsible leaders explain to them the consequences of the choices before them. And in our modern history, never have we been in a more important point need for that than right now. Because the consequences of the road we choose is real. The President of the United States and those who support him are giving us a false choice. The choice is not between big government and big business. The choice is not between Wall Street and Washington. The choice is whether we still believe in ourselves. Do we believe Americans have run out of good ideas? Or do we believe there's a bunch of good ideas waiting to take place, if only we would let them? Do we believe that Americans have forgotten how to create jobs and economic prosperity? Or do we believe that there are countless Americans that have more good ideas that they can possibly pursue, and all they need is the confidence to go after it? And do we believe that the world is a better place if America is diminished, if somehow we back up and allow the United Nations and China and all these other countries to take a lead? Or do we believe that there is nothing still, to this day, there is no replacement on this planet for the American example and ultimately the American leadership? Because I don't believe these things, I know these things. I know them for a fact. And I'll tell you, if we don't know them for a fact, and if we don't act on them, we will be the first Americans to see a diminished nation. And the nation that we know and grew up in won't be the same one you leave your children and grandchildren. But that is neither inevitable nor unavoidable. But it is the stakes of our time. It is what we are debating right now. And if we are effective at that debate, I have no doubt in my mind which road the American people will choose. Because ultimately, what we are in our core, people say we're a nation of immigrants, we are. But at our core, what we really are is a nation of go-getters. Where every single person in this room could track your lineage back to somebody who came here or has fought their entire life to leave their children better off than themselves. Maybe you're the descendants of slaves who overcame a horrifying institution to stake their claim in the American dream. Maybe your parents, your grandparents, or your great-grandparents came here through Ellis Island or even on the Mayflower or on an airplane from Havana. But they did it because they believed that they were better than what the opportunities they had would allow them to become. And they desperately wanted their children to do better than themselves. And they could only find one place in the world where that was possible. And that's this nation that gave them both the political and the economic freedoms, guaranteed by a limited government and a constitution that allowed them to do that. And those are this is not just about maintaining a national identity. It's about ensuring that there is still at least one place on this earth where anyone from anywhere can accomplish anything if you have the ability and the willingness to work for it. And so as you continue to discuss what it means, the question of a constitutionally small government, it's not just a theoretical conversation, nor an academic one. It truly is at the central core of the issues of our time. And how we answer that question will determine how history will judge us and the nation we will leave behind. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you. I have time for two questions. I apologize. I went longer than I wanted to. That's what happens when they don't bring my teleprompter. So here's how we'll do it. I'll take one question, and if it's good, I'll take a second one. Yes, sir. Started out pretty good. Something about brilliance.
Very inspiring. No, I thought the magic teleprompters were the best I've ever seen. But this was a brilliant speech, very inspiring, yet all the bases. But there was I saw a little tension when you were implying we have to have coercive mechanisms to put out a fire in a private hotel. Look at reason.com and you'll see they're competing private fire services. Why not apply the market?
Is a statement, okay. Next statement. I can take one more. We literally have to go save the Republic. There's a vote at 12:05, so. Yes, sir.
You mentioned at the end of your talk about how we're a nation of immigrants. And how we're a nation of opportunity, and a lot of people come here because of their go-getters, because they want a better opportunity for their family. The immigration laws now are not what they were when people were coming through Ellis Island and the like. Should we, in order to promote more go-getting, in order to promote a freer society, what should we do about those immigration laws at the federal level?
They should be modernized. They should take into account the 21st century is not the 20th, and it's certainly not the 19th. And so that means is that we need to have a modern immigration system that looks at our economy and says, these are our needs, this is our heritage as a people, both as a people of, we are both a nation of immigrants and a nation of laws. We need to have an immigration system that the laws make sense and improve our economy. We also have to have an immigration system that's enforced. We can't be the only country in the world that doesn't enforce its immigration laws. So that means visa reforms. We've looked at a bunch of those. I mean, for example, these are very simple notions, but I mean, if you have $1 million and you want to create jobs in America, we should probably try to figure out a way to get you here, right? If you know, here's another thing that makes not a lot of sense to me. I mean, you know, if a kid is in our colleges and they graduate now, they're 7'1" and can dunk a basketball, you know we're going to keep them. But if they've got a 4.0 in a science, math, or a technology, we're going to send them home. after we spend all that money in our universities to educate them and at our schools. So I think most Americans would tell you that I'm not, you know, when unemployment's at 9%, the need probably is not as high, but we need to have, especially in agriculture, a functional guest worker program. In the 21st century, you're telling me we can't create a system where someone, where a farmer or someone else says, look, I need 15 workers this fall, and you can, people can apply in their home country. They're checked. They get a tamper-proof identification card. They enter the United States. We technologically log that. They work 9, 12 months, whatever the time period is. They go back to their country when they're done so they can be with their families. And next year, if we need them again, they come back again. Other countries do that. Why can't we do that? You know, why can't... So all of those things are possible. And part of the reasons that's contributing... One of the drivers of illegal immigration in our country is a broken legal immigration system. But again, this is about false choices that are presented to us in the modern political paradigm. We are told by many that the only choice is you're either for immigration or against immigration. And I've always told the Republican Party, and I'm starting to, you know, say it even more, that we must be the party of legal immigration. Republicans, and not everyone in this room is a Republican. The Republican Party... can't be the anti-illegal immigration party. It has to be the pro-legal immigration party. And I would hope that we're entering an era where Republicans don't just talk about what we're against. We actually start pointing to some of the things that we're for, that honor our heritage, both as a nation of immigrants, but also as a nation of laws. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you.